Framingham, Massachusetts, were enrolled in a long-term study that followed all aspects of their lifestyles, including diet, to establish what factors are important in the development of heart disease. It is still running strong, now with its third generation of participants. Thousands of medical papers have been written about the Framingham Heart Study, but history has virtually forgotten the Framingham Diet Study. The original Framingham Study. This ambitious study, which ran from 1957 to 1960 and involved over 1,000 participants, attempted to find a connection between dietary fat and blood cholesterol, which researchers already believed existed. After millions of dollars and years of painstaking observation, exasperated researchers failed to discover any discernible correlation between dietary fat and blood cholesterol levels. Whether people ate a lot of fat or very little fat made no difference to cholesterol. These findings clashed vigorously with the prevailing conventional wisdom, and researchers were presented with a choice. They could accept these results and search for a nutritional theory closer to the truth, or they could simply ignore them and continue to believe what had just been proven false. Unfortunately, they took the latter choice. The results were tabulated and then quietly suppressed and never published in a peer-reviewed journal. Dissenters to nutritional orthodoxy, no matter how correct, were not to be tolerated. Decades later, Dr. Michael Eads tracked down a lost copy of this important study. The statistician Tavia Gordon lamented, "Unfortunately, these data were never incorporated into a definitive report by the original investigators, and a large amount of very careful and thoughtful work has lain unused in the Framingham files." The study found that there is a slight negative association between daily intake of total fat and also of animal fat with serum cholesterol level. In other words, the more dietary fat eaten, the lower blood cholesterol. And a local newspaper article from the town of Framingham in 1970 plainly stated, "There is no discernible relationship between reported diet intake and serum cholesterol levels in the Framingham Diet Study group." But the low-fat religion prevailed, and healthy, high-fat foods such as nuts, avocados, and olive oil were incriminated for decades. But the truth cannot be suppressed forever, and other studies went on to confirm that dietary fat does not raise cholesterol. The link between dietary fat and cholesterol was also studied in the community of Tecumseh, Michigan in 1976. The population was divided into three groups based on blood cholesterol levels: low, medium, and high. The dietary habits of each group were compared, and to the researchers' surprise, each group ate identical amounts of fat, animal fats, saturated fats, and cholesterol. Once again, it was clear that eating fat did not raise blood cholesterol. A 1970 article in the Framingham Natick News pointed out that the Framingham Diet Study showed no relationship between diet and blood cholesterol levels. Another study fed one group of volunteers a diet that was 22% fat and a second group a diet that was 39% fat. Baseline cholesterol for both groups was 173 milligrams per deciliter. After 50 days, the cholesterol levels in the low-fat group plummeted to 173 milligrams per deciliter. Oh, high-fat diets don't raise cholesterol much either. After 50 days, cholesterol levels in the high-fat group increased only marginally to 177 milligrams per deciliter. Even following a very strict low-fat diet has no beneficial effects on blood cholesterol. In one study, LDL did decrease marginally by 5%, but HDL also decreased by 6%. Since both bad and good cholesterol dropped, the overall risk profile was not improved. Despite all the evidence to the contrary, national dietary guidelines in the United States and United Kingdom were introduced in 1977 and 1983. Recommending adhering to a low-fat diet in order to reduce the risk of heart disease. A careful meta-analysis and systematic review by Zoe Harcum confirmed that there was no evidence that these recommendations would be effective either at the time of publication or today. Millions of people follow a low-fat, low-cholesterol diet because they think that it's good for their heart, without realizing that these measures were long ago proven ineffective. Frank Hu and Walter Willett at the Harvard School of Public Health wrote in 2001, "It is now increasingly recognized that the low-fat campaign has been based on little scientific evidence and may have caused unintended health consequences." So does this mean that the only reliable way to lower blood cholesterol is to take drugs? Hardly. There is one simple, natural measure that lowers cholesterol. Fasting. Why fasting lowers cholesterol? The liver produces the vast majority of cholesterol found in the blood. Eating less cholesterol has almost no effect on the liver's production. In fact, it may be counterproductive. As the liver senses less incoming cholesterol, it may simply increase its own production. So why does fasting affect the liver's production of cholesterol? As dietary carbohydrates decline, the liver decreases its synthesis of triglycerides. Since excess carbohydrates are converted to triglycerides, the absence of carbohydrates means fewer triglycerides. Remember that triglycerides are released from the liver as VLDL, which is the precursor of LDL. Therefore, reduced VLDL eventually results in lowered LDL. The only reliable way to reduce LDL levels is to reduce the liver's production of it. In fact, studies prove that 70 days of alternate day fasting could reduce LDL by 25%. This is far in excess of what can be achieved with almost any other diet and about half of the effect achieved with a statin medication, one of the most powerful cholesterol-lowering medications available. Triglyceride levels drop by 30%, similar to what can be achieved with a very low-carbohydrate diet or medication. Not bad for an all-natural, cost-free dietary intervention. Plus, whereas statins carry the risk of diabetes and Alzheimer's disease, fasting reduces body weight, preserves fat-free mass, and decreases waist circumference. In addition, fasting preserves HDL, unlike low-fat diets, which tend to decrease both LDL and HDL. Overall, fasting produces significant improvements in multiple cardiac risk factors. For people worried about heart attacks and strokes, the question is not, why are you fasting, but why are you not fasting? Chapter 9. What You Need to Know About Hunger. I have discussed the therapeutic use of fasting for obesity and type 2 diabetes with hundreds of patients over the years. Most, if not all, people understand fundamentally why this treatment is undeniably effective. If you don't eat, you will lose weight. If you don't eat, your blood sugar will decrease. Yet, almost universally, there is still an initial severe resistance to the idea of even attempting to incorporate fasting into their lives. Why? One fear stands like a colossus above all others. Hunger. Without a doubt, uncontrollable hunger is the most common worry about fasting. Even some experts proclaim incorrectly that this will leave you prone to severe overeating once the fast is over. They say, don't miss a single meal, otherwise you will be so hungry that you will be forced to stuff your face full of Krispy Kreme donuts. And most people worry that they will simply be unable to continue fasting because they will be overwhelmed with hunger. Somewhat surprisingly, practical experience with hundreds of patients shows that while they're on an intermittent fasting regimen, they most often see their hunger diminish, not increase. They often report that despite their own expectations, they are eating less than half their usual amount of food on a daily basis, yet they feel completely full. For most people, this is the most pleasant surprise of fasting. We start to feel hunger pangs approximately 4 hours after our last meal. So if we imagine that fasting for a full 24 hours creates hunger sensations 6 times stronger, and that would be intolerable. But this does not happen. Overcoming hunger often seems a daunting task, but that stems from a fundamental misunderstanding about the nature of hunger. Hunger starts in the mind. We often believe that hunger is simply a natural physiological reaction to not eating, as inevitable as a rainstorm. We have a mental image that as our stomach fills up with food, it signals our brain that we are full. We imagine that as our stomach empties and drops below a critical threshold, our brain signals us to eat. That is not the entire truth. Consider how hungry you feel first thing in the morning. Studies of circadian rhythm confirm that for most people, hunger is very low first thing in the morning, even though it has been 12 to 14 hours since the last meal. Conversely, hunger at dinner time is often very high, even though we have often eaten lunch just a mere 6 hours ago. Hunger, obviously, is not simply a reflection of the amount of food filling our stomach. Instead, hunger is partly a learned phenomenon. Even when we don't think we're hungry, smelling a steak and hearing it sizzle may make us quite ravenous. These kinds of food-related stimuli do not need to be learned. They're innate in almost everyone. But we can also learn to become hungry during conditions that are intrinsically unrelated with food. For example, the sound of a dinner bell can create hunger where it had not previously existed. The power of these stimuli was demonstrated by the classic experiments of Pavlov's dogs. In the 1890s, the Russian scientist Ivan Pavlov was studying salivation in dogs. Dogs salivate when they see food and expect to eat. This reaction occurs naturally and without training. In his experiments, lab assistants fed the dogs, and the dogs soon began to associate lab coats with eating. There is nothing intrinsically appetizing about a man in a lab coat, but because the dogs consistently were fed by a lab coat-wearing man, the lab coat and food became paired in the dogs' minds. Soon the dogs began to salivate at the sight of the lab coats alone, even if food was not present. Ivan Pavlov, genius that he was, noticed this association, and before you know it, he was packing his bags to Stockholm to receive his Nobel Prize. The applicability of this Psychology 101 lesson to hunger is obvious. We can become hungry for many reasons. Some stimuli naturally make us hungry, such as the smell and sizzle of steak. Other stimuli need to be consistently associated with food in order to provoke hunger on their own. These conditioned responses can be very powerful. In fact, there are measurable physical reactions to the mere suggestion of food. Salivation, pancreatic fluid secretion, and insulin production increase immediately upon the expectation, not the actual delivery of food. This helps synchronize the gut response and the incoming food and is known as the cephalic phase response. The reason great restaurants spend so much time and energy on plating food is because they understand that our enjoyment does not begin with the first bite. It begins when we see the food. An attractively plated meal makes us hungrier than the same food slopped haphazardly into a dog dish. Hunger, in this case, starts with the eyes. But there are infinite other possible associations with foods that make us hungry. If we consistently eat every morning at 7 a.m., then we develop a conditioned response to that time and become hungry at 7 a.m., even if we ate a huge meal at dinner the night before. The same applies to lunch and dinner time. We become hungry merely because of the time, not any true intrinsic hunger. This is learned only through decades of association. Children, on the other hand, often refuse food early in the morning because they are simply not hungry. Hunger starts in the mind. Similarly, by consistently pairing movies with delicious popcorn and sugary drinks, the mere thought of a movie may make us hungry. Food companies, of course, spend billions of dollars trying to condition us to make these associations. Food at the ball game, food at the movies, food while watching TV, food in between halves at our kids' soccer games. food while listening to a lecture, food at a concert, conditioned responses every one. The possibilities are endless. There is a coffee shop or fast food restaurant on every corner. There are vending machines in every nook and cranny of every building in North America. And if we start salivating like Pavlov's dog every 4 hours simply because the clock says it's time to eat, and we're conditioned to associate the sight of the golden arches with eating, is it little wonder we find it increasingly difficult to resist McDonald's? We are bombarded daily with images of and references to food. The combination of their convenience and our ingrained Pavlovian response is deadly and fattening. How can we fight this? Defeating hunger conditioning. Intermittent fasting offers a unique solution. By randomly skipping meals and varying the intervals at which we eat, we can break our habit of eating 3 times a day, come hell or high water. We no longer have a conditioned response of hunger every 3 to 5 hours. We no longer become hungry simply because it's noon or we're at the movies. That's not to say we don't get hungry at all. We do, but not simply because we have a conditioned response to a certain time or occasion. Instead, we get hungry because we are hungry. We allow our body to tell us when it needs nourishment rather than eating by the clock. Have you ever been so busy at work or school that you simply forgot to eat breakfast and lunch? You were simply too focused on the task at hand to heed any of the numerous hunger cues. Your body just used some of the plentiful energy stored as body fat as fuel. Fasting All-Stars, Amy Berger. For most people, the biggest obstacles to fasting are psychological rather than physiological. In the modern industrialized world, we are accustomed to eating round the clock. We eat when we're happy, sad, bored, excited, stressed out, lonely, watching television, celebrating, and just about anything and everything else. In order to fast successfully, try to divorce yourself from the notion that you are supposed to eat several times a day. It is okay, beneficial in fact, to become reacquainted with feelings of hunger. In fact, it's actually kind of nice to get reacquainted with the signals our bodies send us. When we finally allow them to come, though, we are wired for feast and famine, not feast, feast, feast. Here's the simplest way to break associations between food and anything else. Eat only at the table. No eating at your computer station, no eating in the car, no eating on the couch, no eating in bed, no eating in the lecture hall, no eating at the ball game. Try to avoid mindless eating. Every meal should be enjoyed as a meal, not as something eaten while watching a movie. In this way, food becomes associated only with the kitchen and the table. These are not new ideas, of course. It was just common sense in your grandmother's generation. But in breaking habits, going cold turkey is not often successful. Instead, it is better to replace one habit with another, less harmful habit. This is, of course, the reason that people who are trying to quit smoking often chew gum. If your habit is to eat munchies while watching television, simply stopping will make you feel like something is missing. Instead, replace that snacking habit with a habit of drinking a cup of herbal or green tea. Yes, this may seem weird at first, but you will feel a lot less like something is missing. Ultimately, swapping one habit for another is a far more successful strategy. It's also helpful to avoid artificial sweeteners. Even though they contain no calories, they may still kick off the cephalic phase response, stimulating hunger as well as insulin production. I don't recommend artificial sweeteners during fasting for this very reason. Recent studies confirm that diet sodas are generally not helpful for weight loss, probably because they trigger hunger but don't satisfy it. Fasting All-Stars, Abel James. Fasting can be a powerful tool to recalibrate your relationship with eating habits and perceived hunger. True hunger is generally experienced in the body and brain, not in the stomach. It may take some practice, but once you reconnect with the feeling of true hunger, you can follow your body's lead and eat whenever the feeling strikes. Handling hunger conditioning during fasting. Our conditioned response to feel hunger at certain stimuli and the cephalic phase response mean that there are certain things we can do to make fasting easier. Of course, there are many natural stimuli to hunger that cannot entirely be abolished. However, following some simple rules will make hunger much easier to handle. First, as mentioned above, artificial sweeteners can kick off the cephalic phase response, triggering hunger and insulin production, so I recommend avoiding them during a fast. There are certainly people who feel that adding sweeteners to their coffee helps them lose weight by increasing compliance with their fast, and if it works for you, great. But my best advice is to try to fast without the use of sweeteners. If you cannot do that, then try adding a small amount. However, if it makes fasting harder or prevents you from seeing results, then stop. Second, try to physically remove yourself from all food stimuli during a fast. Cooking a meal or even just seeing and smelling food while fasting is almost unbearably difficult. This is not simply a matter of weak willpower. Our cephalic phase responses are fully activated, and to feel those responses without actually eating is like trying to stop a piranha feeding frenzy. This, of course, is the same reason you should not shop for food when hungry or keep snacks in the pantry. Simply breaking the habit of eating at certain times can be difficult. One thing you can try is to make a habit of drinking a large cup of coffee or tea along with breakfast on non-fasting days. On fasting days, you will still miss the food, but having your daily cup of joe will make it easier to not eat. You won't be avoiding the habit of consuming something in the morning. You can also have a bowl of homemade bone broth at dinner time on fasting days. It makes fasting easier in the long run. One of our most important tips for fasting is to stay busy. Working through lunch and staying busy means I often don't even remember to be hungry. My cephalic phase response has not been activated. If somebody were to put food in front of me, I would find it hard to resist, but if there is only a pile of paperwork, I just plow right through and forget to be hungry. The reality of hunger, riding out the wave. There's no denying that you'll experience hunger during fasting, but it's important to remember that hunger is not as terrible an experience as we expect it to be. We often imagine that hunger will build and build until it is unbearable and we need to stuff ourselves with Krispy Kreme donuts. However, this is not the case at all. The secret is to understand that hunger comes in waves. You just need to ride out the waves. Think back to a time when you skipped lunch. Perhaps you were caught up in a meeting and couldn't get away. At first, you got hungry. The hunger built and built, but there was nothing to be done. But what happened after an hour or so? The hunger entirely dissipated. The wave had passed. What's the best way to endure the wave of hunger during fasting? Drinking green tea or coffee is often enough. By the time you're finished, the hunger has passed and you've gone on to the next thing to do that day. Hunger is not a continuously growing phenomenon. It will build up, peak, and then dissipate, and all you have to do is ignore it. It will certainly return, but knowing that it will pass once again gives you the power and confidence to handle it. This even applies to extended fasting periods. Hunger comes quite strongly during the first 1 or 2 days of fasting, generally peaking on day 2. After that, the hunger just subsides and then goes away. Some people speculate that the ketones generated during fat burning are actively suppressing appetite. Dr. Ian Gilliland, an expert in endocrinology, wrote about his experiences with fasting patients that a feeling of well-being is certainly engendered and may amount to euphoria. We did not encounter complaints of hunger after the first day. People weren't hungry and actually felt euphoric during 14 days of fasting. Some people felt so good during fasting that they wanted to continue past the 14 days. In fact, the absence of hunger during extended fasting is a consistent finding throughout the scientific literature on fasting, as well as in our own IDM program. When people feel they cannot go beyond 24 hours of fasting, we sometimes advise them to try 3 to 7 full days of fasting. This sounds completely counterintuitive. If you can't go one day, how can you go 7 days? This hack works because the extended fasting gives people the chance to experience how hunger can disappear without eating as the body learns how to metabolize its own fat. The long fast rapidly acclimates their bodies to fasting. Once they get over the first 1 or 2 days, hunger starts to disappear and they become reassured that they are not overwhelmed by hunger. It is a part of fasting, but not an insurmountable one. How can people fast for days without being hungry? It comes down to the fact that hunger is not determined by not eating for a certain period of time. Rather, it is a hormonal signal. It does not come about simply because the stomach is empty. When you avoid natural stimuli to hunger, such as the sight and smell of food, as well as the conditioned stimuli to hunger, specific mealtimes, movies, ball games, any event where you normally eat and have learned to expect food, you help avoid that hormonal signal. Fasting helps to break all the conditioned stimuli and thus helps to reduce, not enhance, hunger. Hunger is a state of mind, not a state of stomach. Daryl, Fasting Success Story. Daryl, a 66-year-old man, was referred to me in November 2015 for treatment of his type 2 diabetes, which he'd had for 11 years. He also suffered from high cholesterol and high blood pressure, and he had only one kidney. He had been experiencing significant low back pain, caused in part by his abdominal obesity, carrying around all that extra weight around his belly threw off his balance and put significant strain on his lower back. Eventually, this caused arthritis in his spine and crippling low back pain. He was referred to a pain specialist who immediately recognized the classic features of the metabolic syndrome and knew that weight loss would help significantly with his pain. Daryl's diabetes story was typical. He had started with a small dose of a single medication, but over the years, this had relentlessly increased until he was taking 70 units of insulin daily just to keep his blood sugar under control. We started with a low-carbohydrate, high-fat diet and added some intermittent fasting. He fasted for 24 hours at a time, 3 days a week. The results were immediate. His weight and waist size started decreasing. Within a mere 2 weeks, we stopped all his insulin because his blood sugars were consistently in the normal range. He has remained off all his diabetic medications since then, and his most recent hemoglobin A1C measured 5.9, down from 6.8% before he started on our program. In other words, despite stopping all his insulin, his blood sugar levels were better than ever. In fact, he would not even be classified as a diabetic any longer. His diabetes had completely reversed. Imagine that. Daryl suffered with type 2 diabetes for 11 years, and at any time the proper diet could have entirely reversed his diabetes. Daryl could have been injecting himself with insulin for the next 20 years without fixing the underlying problem, but instead, just by following some simple dietary rules, he cured his type 2 diabetes. Chapter 10. Who should not fast? Now that we've talked about the many benefits of fasting, we need to add a very big caveat. Fasting isn't for everyone. It carries certain risks, and normal amounts of vitamins, minerals, and other essential nutrients are not ingested. Some people absolutely should not attempt therapeutic fasting, including those who are severely malnourished or underweight, children under 18 years of age, pregnant women, breastfeeding women. Others should be cautious when fasting, but don't necessarily need to avoid it. In the following situations, it is wise to seek the advice of a healthcare professional before attempting therapeutic fasting. You have gout. You are taking medications. You have type 1 or type 2 diabetes. You have gastroesophageal reflux disease. Absolutely don't fast if you're severely malnourished or underweight. When malnutrition is a concern, it's obviously neither desirable nor wise to deliberately restrict nutrients and calories. When body fat falls below 4%, the body is forced to use protein in order to feed itself. For comparison, average body fat is 25% in men and over 35% in women. This is only an average, and an obese person's body fat percentage is far above that. An elite marathoner, despite looking very lean, might have approximately 8 to 10% body fat. The stored energy from fat has run out, and the body must now burn functional tissue to survive. This syndrome is called wasting, and it's neither healthy nor beneficial in any way. The body mass index, BMI, is calculated by taking your weight in kilograms and dividing it by your height in meters squared, kilograms per meter squared. One well-accepted definition of underweight is a BMI of less than 18.5. For a man who stands 5'10", that would correspond to a weight of 129 pounds. I generally advise against any type of fasting at a BMI below 20, as the risk of complications rises dramatically, but it's especially important to avoid longer fasts. Fasting All-Stars, Amy Berger. I don't like for people to use fasting as an excuse to eat whatever they want in massive quantities when they're not fasting. It should also not be used as a punishment for overeating, cheating, or falling off the wagon of the particular diet program someone is following. It can be used as a kind of recalibration or resetting if someone feels they'll benefit from that, but it shouldn't be used as a quick fix to atone for perceived dietary sins. Sidebar: does fasting cause anorexia? Patients suffering from anorexia nervosa should clearly not be fasting, since they are already severely underweight and malnourished. Further, fasting may feed directly into the manifestations of anorexia nervosa. Food is the medicine of choice for anorexia, so withholding it is ill-advised. However, does fasting cause anorexia? The simple answer is no. Anorexia is a psychiatric disorder of distorted body image. Patients perceive their bodies as overweight, even though they are severely underweight. It is a psychological disease and not one caused by undereating. This is the symptom, not the cause. Fasting is not generally fun, and there is little danger of getting hooked on it. It is certainly not addictive in the way that cocaine is addictive. Arguing that fasting causes anorexia is like arguing that washing your hands will lead to obsessive-compulsive disorder. Excessive hand washing is a symptom of the disease, not its cause. Furthermore, fasting has been practiced safely for thousands of years by millions of people worldwide, but anorexia nervosa is only a very recent phenomenon. If fasting caused anorexia, it would have been described thousands of years ago and affected men as well as women. This argues strongly against fasting as a significant cause. Bottom line? Fasting does not cause anorexia, but it should not be attempted by anorexics. Absolutely don't fast if you're under 18 years old. In children, proper growth outweighs all other health concerns, and adequate nutrition is an absolute prerequisite for normal growth. Restricting calories also restricts the essential nutrients necessary for proper growth and the development of vital organs, especially the brain. The normal growth spurt in puberty, in particular, requires tremendous amounts of nutrients. Underfeeding during this period may result in stunted growth, which may be irreversible. In all children under 18, the risk of malnutrition during fasting is unacceptably high. That's not to say that missing a meal here and there is harmful to children's health, but prolonged fasting longer than 24 hours is not advisable. This fact has long been recognized by virtually all cultures in the world. Children have always been excluded from cultural or religious fasting to prevent the unintentional development of malnutrition at a critical time of development. It is more important to teach children about making proper food choices. Choosing to eat whole, unprocessed, natural foods is a good start. Avoiding highly processed grains and especially reducing added sugars also goes a long way toward preventing obesity and promoting good health. Pregnant. Fasting during pregnancy presents similar concerns about proper fetal development. The developing fetus requires adequate nutrients for optimal growth, and nutrient deficiency may cause irreversible harm during this critical period. For this reason, many women take a specially formulated pregnancy multivitamin. Especially important is folic acid supplementation, as deficiency in folic acid may lead to an increased risk of neural tube defects, for example, the disease spina bifida. Folic acid stores in humans last only several months, so prolonged nutrient deficiency puts the developing fetus at enormous risk. Since pregnancy is limited to 9 months, there is no reason to fast during this time. It may be resumed at a safer time once the pregnancy and breastfeeding, coming up next, is over. Once again, most cultures of the world have long recognized the inherent danger of fasting during this time and exempt pregnant women from cultural and religious fasts. Developing babies receive all their nutrients from the mother in the form of breast milk. If mom becomes deficient in vitamins and minerals, then the baby will also be deficient. The result may be irreversible growth retardation. For that reason, I do not advise anybody who is breastfeeding to undertake fasting. Missing a meal here or there is certainly not harmful, but deliberate long-term fasting is not advised. Again, since breastfeeding is generally limited to months, not years, there is no reason to fast. Once you've finished breastfeeding, you may safely fast without fear of harming your baby. Fasting is an activity that can be done safely throughout most of your adult life, but it is foolish to attempt to fast during those few times when it presents a danger to your own health or the health of your baby. There is simply no reason to rush into it. There is always plenty of time to fast later when it is safe to do so. Consult your doctor if you have gout. Gout is an inflammatory arthritis caused by excess uric acid crystals in the joints. High blood levels of uric acid are one of the major contributing factors to this disease, and medications to lower the level of uric acid in the blood are sometimes prescribed to reduce the chance of recurrence. Uric acid elimination through the urine decreases during fasting, resulting in a rise in uric acid levels. Theoretically, this could worsen gout. In a study of 42 obese patients who fasted, there was increased uric acid in all patients, but none developed gout. Most patients with a history of gout tolerate fasting without difficulty. However, knowing the potential risk is important, and if you have any doubts, speak with your physician before starting your fasting regimen. Consult your doctor if you are taking medications. Anybody who is taking regular medications for any condition must consult with their physician before starting any type of dietary or fasting program. Certain medications are best taken with food, which obviously is not possible during fasting. The most common medications that cause problems during fasting are aspirin, metformin, and iron and magnesium supplements. But it is often possible to arrange the fasting schedule to accommodate these medications. Aspirin is commonly used as a blood thinner in people with cardiovascular disease. One common side effect is gastritis, the irritation of the lining of the stomach. In severe cases, it may cause ulcers to form in the stomach and small intestine. Aspirin is often taken with food to lessen the risk of these complications. Many aspirin tablets are now coated with a protective film to protect the lining of the stomach, but the risk of gastritis and ulcers is only reduced, not eliminated. Taking aspirin without food raises the risk of stomach irritation. Metformin is the most widely prescribed medication in the world for type 2 diabetes. This blood sugar-lowering medication has been used since the 1950s and is also commonly prescribed for polycystic ovary syndrome. One major side effect is gastrointestinal upset, which may become worse on an empty stomach. The most commonly reported symptoms are diarrhea and nausea or vomiting. Iron supplement tablets are commonly prescribed for low blood counts due to chronic blood loss, also called iron deficiency anemia. For example, many women have heavy monthly periods that lead to low iron levels. Among the most common side effects of iron supplements are both constipation and abdominal pain, which may be made worse by fasting. Magnesium is a mineral stored largely in the bones. Supplements are often taken to treat leg cramps, migraine headaches, and restless leg syndrome. It is also used as an antacid and laxative. Magnesium supplements taken orally are often poorly absorbed through the intestines, leading to diarrhea. Taking magnesium with food often reduces these symptoms. Low magnesium levels are particularly common in type 2 diabetes. As an alternative, magnesium may be absorbed through the skin through Epsom salts, crystals of magnesium sulfate. You can dissolve a full cup of Epsom salts in a tub of warm water and soak for 30 minutes. The magnesium will be absorbed through the skin. This is a traditional remedy for many things, including muscle cramps, constipation, and skin problems. Alternatively, there are preparations of magnesium oil or magnesium gel that may be applied to the skin. Consult your doctor if you have diabetes. If you have type 1 or type 2 diabetes, it's essential to be particularly careful while fasting or even just changing dietary patterns. This is especially true if you're taking medications. If you continue the same dose of medication but reduce food intake, there is a risk of your blood sugar going extremely low, a situation called hypoglycemia. Symptoms of hypoglycemia include shaking, sweating, irritability, or nervousness, feeling faint, hunger, and nausea. More severe symptoms include confusion, delirium, and seizures. Untreated, hypoglycemia may even lead to death. Symptoms may appear very rapidly, and if they do, you must quickly ingest some sugary beverage or food to reverse this life-threatening situation. You must consult with a physician to adjust the doses of diabetic medications or insulin before starting any dietary program. Careful monitoring of blood sugars is crucially important. If you cannot do this, then you should not attempt fasting. Consult your doctor if you have gastroesophageal reflux disease. In gastroesophageal reflux disease, GERD, commonly known as heartburn, stomach acid backs up into the esophagus, causing damage to the sensitive tissues of the esophagus. This feels like a dull pain in the lower chest or upper abdomen and often becomes worse when lying down. People often describe feeling their stomach contents coming back up. Excessive abdominal fat places increased pressure on the stomach and forces food and stomach acid back up into the esophagus. This can occasionally be made worse during fasting because there is nothing in the stomach to absorb the stomach acid. This is mildly and sadly ironic since fasting is often undertaken for the purposes of losing weight, which should ultimately make the heartburn better. After weight loss is achieved, heartburn often resolves. Sometimes fasting improves symptoms of heartburn because food can stimulate the production of stomach acid, so fasting reduces it. Here are some simple techniques to help reduce symptoms of GERD. Avoid foods that aggravate reflux, including chocolate, caffeine, alcohol, fried foods, and citrus. Caffeine relaxes the lower esophageal sphincter, which may worsen reflux. Finish eating at least 3 hours before bed. Go for a walk after dinner. Elevate the head of the bed with blocks. Try alkaline water or water with lemon. Take over-the-counter medications such as antacids, bismuth solutions, or ranitidine, Zantac. Ask your physician about stronger prescription medications such as proton pump inhibitors. If these strategies do not work, it is often possible to modify the fasting regimen to avoid heartburn. For example, rather than doing a true fast, try eating a handful of salad greens at regular intervals. This preserves most of the benefits of the fast while alleviating the symptoms of heartburn. A fat fast in which only fat is eaten during the fasting period may also be effective. We'll address this later in the book. Should women fast? I'm often asked whether women should fast. I am not sure where the rumor that women shouldn't fast started, but I have heard it often enough to address this question specifically. There is some persistent concern that women may not experience the same benefits of fasting as men. Nothing could be further from the truth. Virtually all studies on fasting confirm that both men and women benefit from fasting. Further, there is no particular difference in efficacy between the two sexes. My own clinical experience confirms this. Having helped hundreds of men and women fast over the last 5 years, I've seen no differences between the sexes. If anything, women tend to do better. Many of our greatest success stories are women. Megan, program director, improved her health so much with fasting protocols that she left her career in medical research to help others succeed with fasting. While women can, of course, have problems during fasting, men often have the same troubles too. Interestingly, I've seen the highest success rates with husbands and wives who try fasting together. The mutual support is a big help and makes fasting far easier. Fasting has been part of human culture for at least 2,000 years. Are Muslim women exempt from fasting? Are Buddhist women exempt from fasting? Are Catholic women exempt from fasting? Nope. With thousands of years of practical fasting experience, none of these religions make a distinction between adult men and women, except when women are pregnant or breastfeeding. One area of specific concern with women is that fasting could affect reproductive hormones. Certainly, malnourished women should not fast, since excessively low body fat can lead to amenorrhea, loss of menstrual cycles, and difficulty conceiving. But normal weight women do not see a significant difference in their sex hormone profile during fasting. One study examined the effect of a 3-day fast on the reproductive hormones during different parts of the menstrual cycle. Glucose and insulin levels stayed low, showing compliance with the fast, but all reproductive hormones remained within normal limits. Ultrasound also demonstrated normal growth of the dominant follicle, egg, and menstrual cycles remained unchanged. The problems of amenorrhea and anovulatory cycles, menstrual cycles where no egg is produced, arise when body fat percentage falls too low. However, women with excessively low body fat should not be fasting in the first place, neither should men for that matter. If amenorrhea or any other menstrual problems appear during fasting, stop immediately. Fasting All-Stars, Dr. Michael Ruscio. It's important to track whatever your key symptoms are. It's also important to assess if globally you appear to be getting better or worse as the days go on. If you are generally getting better, then stick with it. If you feel you are generally getting worse, then your current approach may not be suited for you and you might want to try a different fasting approach. Pregnant and breastfeeding women, as previously noted, should not fast. These are situations that absolutely require adequate nutrients for growth. Let's be clear. There are certainly potential problems women may face during fasting, but all these problems come up with men too. Sometimes women don't lose weight the way they want, and sometimes neither do men. Sometimes women find that fasting is difficult, as do men. The studies on fasting, many going back over 100 years, all show that it's safe for both sexes. The most important thing to always remember is that if you are feeling poorly in any way, whether you are a man or a woman, you must stop fasting immediately and contact your healthcare provider. Part 2. How to Fast. Chapter 11. Kinds of Fasts and Best Practices. It's useful to categorize fasts by two features: what is allowed on the fast, and how long or frequent the fast is. We'll take up the questions of length and frequency in chapters 12, 13, and 14. But first, let's look at the different kinds of fasts in terms of what may be consumed. Most definitions of fasting allow non-caloric drinks only. This means that water, tea, and black coffee are all allowed during fasting. But sugar, honey, fructose, agave nectar, and other sugars are prohibited. There is some disagreement about artificial sweeteners like stevia, aspartame, and sucralose. Since there are no calories in these, technically, they could be allowed. However, the use of chemicals in these artificial sweeteners defeats the spirit of fasting, which is to cleanse or purify the body, not only from unwanted sugars and fats, but also from chemicals and other artificial agents. The same argument applies to artificial flavors, such as those in Crystal Light or Kool-Aid, and to bouillon cubes. The water-only fast is a traditional and classic variant. All other beverages and additives are not permitted during the fasting period. It's important to note that this fast generally includes zero salt. Without salt, the body cannot hold on to water, and therefore there is some risk of dehydration. Some variants of the water-only fast allow you to drink salt water, although it can be difficult to get down. However, the body has a remarkable ability to retain salt when it is not readily available in the diet. This means that as long as the water-only fast is limited in duration, your salt requirements will be fairly low, and salt deficiency shouldn't be a problem. Juice fasting permits the consumption of juice as well as water. Since juices naturally contain sugars and calories, this is not technically a true fast, but the word is often used in this context. Results of this fast will vary depending upon the type and amount of juice consumed. Fruit juices tend to be very high in sugar and therefore will often not produce as good a result as other stricter fasts. Green juice fasting has recently surged in popularity. As you might guess from the name, this involves juicing green leafy vegetables like spinach and kale. The resulting juice contains far less sugar than the juice of sweet fruits like oranges and apples. In addition, leafy vegetables contain little actual juice, so the leaves are often ground up and blended with the juice, which provides fiber and nutrients. Celery is often juiced in this mixture too. The fat fast is a newer variation of fasting. Relatively pure fats, such as coconut oil, cream, and butter, are allowed during this fast, so it, too, is not a true fast. Fat is normally not eaten in isolation. We rarely drink a cup of olive oil or eat a pat of butter by itself, but some people feel that eating fat this way helps reduce hunger and makes fasting much easier. Fasting All-Stars, Amy Berger. During a fast, small amounts of pure fat or almost pure fat, a spoonful of olive or coconut oil, a pat of butter, and for some, even a very small amount of solid food, such as macadamia nuts or walnuts, something that is primarily fat with a negligible amount of carbohydrate and little to no protein, can be consumed without interfering with the physiological benefits of the fast. Sometimes just having a small bite of something like this can help a person stick to a fast when they might otherwise be struggling, and these foods are unlikely to be obstacles to getting the desired results. The popularity of bulletproof coffee has helped this trend. To make coffee bulletproof, you add fat in the form of coconut oil, medium-chain triglycerides, MCT oil, or butter from grass-fed cows. The high fat content of the coffee gives this drink a substantial number of calories, 400 to 500 per cup, depending upon the recipe. so this would be more accurately termed a meal replacement. However, virtually all the calories are derived from fat. We have a recipe for bulletproof coffee in the accompanying PDF that came with this purchase. There are a number of purported benefits to the fat fast. Some claim that it helps weight loss as part of a ketogenic or very low carbohydrate diet in which the body burns fat for energy. Others feel that the fat helps with mental clarity or that it helps kill cravings. While scientific proof of the effectiveness of the fat fast is currently scarce, anecdotes of success abound. In a dry fast, no fluids of any kind are allowed. Muslims practice this type of fasting during the daylight hours of the holy month of Ramadan. This combines fasting with mild dehydration. In my opinion, this makes fasting much more difficult than other types of fasts, and I do not recommend this for medical reasons. The risk of complications is also much higher due to the accompanying dehydration. The fasting mimicking diet is a diet created by researchers to recreate the benefits of fasting without actual fasting. It is a complicated regimen of reduced caloric intake over 5 days every month. The first day allows 1,090 calories, composed of 10% protein, 56% fat, and 34% carbohydrate. That's followed by 4 days of 725 calories with the same nutritional breakdown. There is sparse data to support the claim that this diet provides all the benefits of fasting, and I don't recommend it because of its unnecessary complexity. To me, it is far simpler to follow 5 days of regular fasting per month. Fasting All-Stars, Dr. Thomas Seyfried. All types of fasts can have therapeutic benefit. The key to therapy is prolonged therapeutic ketosis, blood ketones in the range of 3 to 6 millimolar, together with reduced blood glucose levels, 3 to 4 millimolar. Patients will need to use the precision extra meter from Medisense to determine when they can enter the therapeutic zone. GKI ratios of 1.0